Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Being up here with Tony Johnson, who has been both a friend and a colleague with me since I came to New Jersey, and who is now walking with you as you head in new directions. This is truly special. Thank you. So after 16 years, I've decided to do three things today. The first, I want to tell you just a couple stories about the past of this congregation that at least some of you newer members may not know. Second, I'd like to briefly expand upon the beginning of that meditation before, since that perspective on who we are is perhaps the most important thing that I've ever come across in my own life. It's been a constant for me, so many of you elders may remember this, but I think it bears repeating. And lastly, third, I'd share a bit about the issue that has grown steadily in importance for me over these past several years, that of climate change, now being brought together with other issues of justice in climate justice. So do the stories. The first one involves that fireplace right at the back of the room here, because in the 1930s, the discussion groups, the forum of this congregation gathered around that fireplace and invited speakers in on Sundays. And a young member of this congregation, a gifted violinist by the name of Helen Canothe, was sent by her father, who was in charge of those discussions, to ask a young economics professor from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania to come and speak. His name was Scott Nearing. And he had been canned because he wrote a little too passionately against child labor and also because he was a socialist. So he was blackballed and became one of the big blackball intellectual freedom cases of the last century. But he's kicking around at his parents' house across town. She goes to invite him. Their eyes meet. She comes to the lecture. They fall in love. And like many poor people before them, they decided to go and homestead, first up in Vermont, then in Maine, building their own homes, growing their own vegetables, and writing a book called Living the Good Life, which inspired the whole Back to the Land movement in this country, which then eventuated in all kinds of other ventures coming out of that idea of going back and living a good life on the land. Started right here at that fireplace. Then later on, you embarked on a creative and courageous adventure when you gave a home here to one of the great geniuses of our movement, Kenneth Patton. And he, with Tony Valonis and a bunch of others, created an extraordinary environment in here for arts and for religion and science and all else, of which you see remnants up here at the podium now. But many other congregations would not have dared to take on such a creative, strong-minded, and independent minister such as Ken Patton. But you all did, and I think you deserve a lot of credit for that, because he went on to write extraordinary stuff after he came here. Then later, and some of you here will know more about this, in the 1990s, when our space became too small for us, we needed an expansion. And that, coming as it did in the middle of the village of Ridgewood, demanded extraordinary tact and persistence and patience and overall gumption. And if you ever get Bob Jones, the president at that time, with a glass, maybe two glasses of wine in him, and ask him about that time, he'll fill you in. But so can a lot of other people in this room. It was an incredible achievement to pull off. It would not have happened without the vision and the financial sacrifice of Art Tone, who had to call upon the revolutionary spirit of his Irish ancestor, Wolf Tone, to hang in there during the early days. But everybody pitched in, and what really strikes me is that the capital fundraising campaign was headed by Dwight Dodick and Helen Lindsay, who, with our female UUA consultant, made a very successful campaign and made it the first woman-led one of its kind that I know about. Anybody knows of a capital campaign headed all by women, let me know. And this is back in the 1990s. And speaking of fundraising, I just want to say I hope all you newer people know that this congregation won the highest award from the UUA for its creative fundraising for capital for annual fundraising on their spoofs of Broadway musicals. You won some awards for that, and you're known all over the UUA for those, by the way. But to complete the building story, you all then pulled off a completed building project within 1% of budget. Now, to my mind, that is the equivalent of Robin Hood putting his arrow right in the center of the target in Nottingham, splitting the arrow of the previous archer. 1%. If any of you know of a building program that came in within 1% of budget ever, anywhere else, let me know, because I'll step back. But things such as these, plus all you've done in terms of justice work and social action and community involvement, have made you respected and well-known not only around here, but also in the UUA at large. You should be sitting proud. Now, second to that question of our place in the universe and our dignity, I'm not going to say too much because that opening song by Isaiah Barnwell of Sweet Honey and the Rock, our own Unitarian Universalist black a cappella group, says a lot about our ancestors. And if we just start with our ancestors, even though we do not know all the particulars of their lives, especially back a couple generations, we do know enough about history and the kinds of things that we know they had to have gone through in order to get us here, each one of us here alive now upon this planet. And knowing their dangers and knowing their sacrifices ought to have us all standing full and proud and trying also to live lives worthy of their journeys. But even beyond our ancestors, we now know ever since the late 20th century when the particle physicists and the cosmologists came together and solved each other's theoretical problems, that the cosmos has been an elegant unfoldment from the extremely high energy environment of the Big Bang on, of extremely small to ever larger particles, from simple elements to more complex ones, to molecules and on, with each step in that unfoldment making possible more complex relationships and greater creative possibilities. So Alan Watts is right. We each, standing as we now are at the unfoldment of that whole process into the future, don't just find ourselves here as if we sort of plop down into life upon this planet. We emerge out from this whole stupendous process, part, parcel, body, and psyche. And with this vast dignity of our origin, we also get, at the same time, infinite humility, since absolutely none of this is due to us. We are simply given this miracle of life and this inheritance that all of us come from. And I know for me that this awareness, fleeting as it often is, has made all the difference in my own spiritual journey. And I cannot help but think that many of us are drawn to spirituality and religion in order to see ourselves in a broader context than a lot of the world provides us, especially the unceasing identification messages that are thrown at us constantly here from those with profit motives trying to bend our being and our identity to fit what they're selling. We are so much more than that, but we need some kind of practice to remind us. As Thomas Berry, the great beginning, one of the founders of the ecological movement, put it, this miracle we are all part of is, in fact, the real greatest story ever told, because it is the origin of all the various creation myths upon this planet and all the attempts of religions to evoke its majesty. And thirdly, in many ways, what we are up against on climate now needs all of us, those within what is known as the faith community, and also those who are not. And that's why a group of us began Interfaith Moral Action on Climate, IMAC. Maybe not the best name, but an attempt to say we were trying to encourage the various faith traditions to work together, and at the time they were all still kind of silent, to meet the climate crisis, to step in and step up and add their weight to the cause, and at the same time to include everybody else in the process with the wider word moral, because you don't have to be religious to be moral, as we all know. But so we've staged interfaith services from people from all over the earth, and then processions to the White House pleading with the administration to do something about this crisis. We've endorsed, when necessary, risking arrest and civil disobedience actions, and thus losing the Baha'is and being a little bit edgier than a lot of the mainstream religious groups. Jim Hansen's been at one of our events, and I remember him carrying a huge papier-mâché earth about this big, and it was kind of heavy, and he refused. We kept saying to dispel him. It was for hours. He refused to put the earth down. He carried it the whole time. But further, we have intentionally reached out to the evangelicals, who are often ignored by the rest of the religious community because some of their elders are still fighting the Scopes trial from the 1920s. Okay? And by the way, evangelicals are not fundamentalists and they're not Pentecostals. I'm learning more about that part of religion in America than I ever knew. But we met with the board of the U.S. Board of Evangelicals, and we talked with them, and we watched as they together were trying to figure out how to hold the evangelical movement together, from their elderly Rush Limbaugh ditto heads to their young people, who are either leaving them in large numbers or are insisting that their elders finally get with this issue. Matter of fact, a lot of evangelical young people are now dedicating their lives, when they do their altar call, they're dedicating their lives to Christ and to the planet. Okay, that's what's going on. 60 million strong, listening to their board, I know that the evangelicals are going to have to go with their youth. They've got to think about it. We also spoke with the head of the worldwide evangelicals, Jeffrey Tunnicliffe, and he assured us that the evangelicals worldwide get climate change big time, because they're looking at it every day. And they look upon their United States brothers and sisters as benighted family. We're the U.S. evangelicals, they can't believe how benighted they are. And they see them as being led astray by the multi-billion dollar disinformation campaign in this country that's been financed by the petro companies, using the exact same tactics as big tobacco used years ago with cigarettes and smoking. Matter of fact, same law, same PR firms, law firms, some of the same people. The worldwide evangelicals, and I find this ironic and hopeful, are actually on our side trying to wake up their U.S. brethren. IMAC also decided to have an interfaith response when the Pope came to address Congress on climate. At the time we decided to do that, we had $39 in the bank, I remember, because we were wondering what we were going to do. But we were the first ones on the block to go out and get permits for the mall when the Pope was going to be there to have a big interfaith rally. And then we knew enough, obviously, to reach out and form a wider coalition with other groups that had experience in organizing large events and also had financial resources, such as Earth Day Network. So that when the Pope did come to address Congress, there were big jumbotrons up on the Mall so that everybody could hear his address. And there was a huge stage on the Mall with speakers and singers from many different cultures from all over the world, including, for the first time ever, the leader of the Young Evangelicals of America, standing there and speaking beside young leaders from many other religious organizations and traditions and environmental groups, and on. Even more recently, Interfaith Moral Action on Climate went to the chairs of the Progressive Caucus in Congress. And we suggested to them, asked them to hold a forum on what has come out about Exxon's lying to the public and its own stockholders about the threat of fossil fuels, both to the climate and also to profits, when the nations of the world actually start asking them not to extract their resources. That happened last June, and we're hoping to have another such forum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership this fall. Don't know if that's going to happen, but we're trying. But I get ahead of myself, because when I left here in 2000, the climate crisis was really not on my radar. UUs for Social Justice in Washington area dealt at various times with healthcare for all, with LGBTQ issues, with the treatment of immigrants, with the widening wealth gap in this country, with anti-racism, and environmental concerns from pollution on up to climate. At that time, my first arrest was about Darfur. Remember when we were talking about whether Darfur was genocide or not? And it turned out 7 congressmen and a bunch of faith leaders were going to get arrested at the Sudanese embassy, and the UUA wanted a representative. The president couldn't make it, and I was the local sap. So I was invited to get arrested. I did. But I'm sitting in my cell afterwards, and the head of the Secret Service group that had arrested us came up to me, and he said, "I understand you're from Baltimore." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, does this name mean anything to you?" And he showed me his name tag, and it was Tom Mutscheller. And I reached back into my memory, and I came up with, wait a minute, wasn't Jim Mutscheller a tight end for the Baltimore Colts when Johnny Unitas was their quarterback? And he broke into this big beaming smile. He said, "Tight end and defensive linebacker." He played both sides of the ball in those days. So I was rewarded with all the free bologna sandwiches I wanted, which wasn't a lot. But nevertheless, you know, looking back on that, what occurs to me is that not any of us thought for a moment that we were actually dealing with a climate war, one of the early ones, which happens whenever you have ethnic groups who are getting desperate trying to feed their families, and either there's not enough water for their livestock or for planting or for growing their crops. And what do? They fight each other and they get into wars. We were all in the dark on climate. So that's where we were not too long ago, but gradually it became clear to lots of others and also to me that no issue we cared about stood much of a chance for any kind of resolution if we didn't also, at the same time, somehow deal with climate. Because our human Achilles heel is our food supply. That's where we start getting desperate. And that supply is threatened with the rising oceans, with the increase of desertification or deluge, with more violent weather fronts, with disrupted weather cycles, so that farmers in many places now no longer even know when to plant their crops. All their ancient wisdom is lost. The food chain in the oceans is also at risk because those oceans are taking the hit on temperature rise, protecting all of us and land, and they're taking the hit on carbon dioxide absorption, which is acidifying them and thus endangering the shells of all the sea creatures in the food chain there. We all know about the loss of mountain glaciers and thus the danger of rivers going dry in the summer that they feed. We know about the spread of tropical diseases and the threat of sea level rise to low-lying areas The EPA now estimates very conservatively that by 2100 that'll be at least 2 feet everywhere, and a lot of other people are saying 10 feet. And the EPA is also estimating, again rather conservatively, a lot of people think, a 3 to 12 degree Fahrenheit temperature rise here on the land in the U.S. So if you think these days have been hot, just add 3 to 12 degrees to them to see probably what's coming, maybe more. And we all know that almost always it is the most vulnerable and those who have done the least to bring this to pass who are and will suffer the most. Carbon Tracker did the first analysis, but it's been confirmed by the World Bank, Standard & Poor's, and a bunch of other big number crunchers, that we are going to have to leave about 3/4 of our fossil fuel reserves, oil, gas, and coal, in the ground to keep anywhere near the 2 degrees Celsius or centigrade rise that was agreed upon in Copenhagen as being the most we could do and still really try to keep civilization as we've known it going. We're shooting past that goal. But we also have found out that natural gas is, in fact, as bad or worse than coal in terms of heat rise from leakage over its life cycle. Because if you take into account the fact that methane is 86 times as potent as CO2 over its 20 years in the atmosphere, that's why fracking is such an environmental disaster. Public health considerations not even considered. To head off into building a 50-year infrastructure for a disastrous fuel is sheer insanity. It's as dangerous, that methane leakage from fracking, as the methane leakage is from the tundras, of which everybody's really worried, because if that methane starts leaking into the atmosphere, it threatens a runaway feedback loop, which will be beyond any human control. Bad news. Good news. There is a vigorous debate about the place of nuclear fuel as we necessarily transition over to renewable energy resources. Jim Hansen, citing new standards and safeguards of nuclear fuel and the absolute necessity to get away from fossil fuels as fast as possible, plus he thinks it's impossible to transition that quickly into other renewables, is for nuclear energy. Other environmentalists think that we can make the transition. It's not technology, it's political will that's the missing ingredient. But what is clear, let that debate go on, it's a good one. But what is clear is that we need to start a massive shift away from fossil fuels now, and that takes public policy shifts. So another good piece of good news is that there is an absolute consensus about all the people that I know of anyway, that the first step is to raise the price of energy, which can be done in a simple and a fair way. It's called cap and dividend. A fee is put on carbon where it's extracted, and that cost is then passed on by market means all the way down. We all pay more, which makes it far, far more simpler than the old cap and trade proposals that came before Congress before. The amount raised from those fees is then divided equally among all citizens, so that poor people come out even or possibly a little bit ahead on their energy costs. It levels the energy playing field so that entrepreneurs and new technologies have a chance to add creative new energy possibilities too. The Citizens Climate Lobby is working full time on passing this through Congress. If you're interested, the Citizens Climate Lobby. But what is also encouraging is that the use of the market process has appeal for Republicans, as well as the fact that none of this money goes to the federal government. It goes, it's distributed among the people. So that's good news. Other good news is the vastly increasing number of people who get the seriousness of this problem, the young people insisting we elders actually get real about it, huge numbers of people standing up to fracking and winning important legislative and court victories. Further, climate change has now been incorporated into many justice issues as climate justice, eliminating the many different silos of traditional justice issues from climate ones that used to separate them before. And the UUA really led the way on that by bringing all of its different organizations and initiatives together and coming up with a plan called Commit to Respond, which gets rid of those silos and bring them together as justice issues. And from the Citizens Climate March in New York City several years ago to the Moral Mondays movement today, as well as the Black Lives Matter, this broad base coming together is creating a major movement for change. Please do yourself a favor and go to the UU website. It's also in your summer newsletter here, I see. And listen to Reverend William Barber of Moral Mondays talk about what they're up to. It's absolutely inspiring. Moral Mondays, Reverend William Barber. Another big favor you can do is to go see Josh Fox's new documentary, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. And if you can't find it around here, set up a local viewing. The first 6 minutes show all of the bad news and more that I've been talking about. But then Josh Fox, and he admitted that after looking at all that, he kind of felt like going into his living room, shutting the door, and watching old movies for a couple years because it was so hopeless. But then he asked himself a really important question, really important. He asked himself, well, what doesn't change as climate changes? What doesn't? Like our human creativity, like our courage, like our persistence in the face of adversity, like our ancestors, like our intelligence. And he then set out to find how others are using these qualities to deal with climate. He went all over the world. And his search took him to places that absolutely led him, he could not imagine why he had ever thought about going into his living room and watching old movies. Because he found it so much more joyous, enriching, heartening, to be with people who are using their courage, their creativity, their persistence to deal with this issue. And anyway, it's a great documentary. And lastly, when I think of the history of these times, one of its great heroes has to be James Hansen. As the consummate scientist, expert on the atmosphere of Venus, he was the first person, he turned his attention then to Earth's atmosphere, and he sounded the first major scientific alarm about our increased warming and its causes. Now, he still keeps to his impeccable scientific procedures, but his love of his grandchildren that Elizabeth wrote about, or read about, turned him into an activist. And I don't know how many times he's been arrested by now. I've been arrested twice with him at big things. And I always go over and introduce myself and say I used to be connected with this. He knows you people. He used to live on South Irvine Street here. But I know now that his heart and his courage are as big as his mind. And that we all need, in our own ways, to somehow stand up for our children and our grandchildren, for their vulnerable, and for the other species. This is what I've learned since I left you good people. It's so good to see you gathered again together. Thank you.